580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 14th, 2010. Today we have a show I've been waiting for a long time. We're going to be talking to the author of a new book, an extraordinarily provocative book that says basically much of what we think about our economy is all wrong. We've got to get it right or else we're in deep trouble. Our guest today will be Barry Lynn, talking about his new book, Cornered, on the role of monopoly in our economy. Well, he'll be here for the first hour. It should be a terrific show. Before we go to our guests, though, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
YouTube and the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting have kicked off a new contest called Project Report 2010. It provides amateur and aspiring journalists with a chance to share their stories with the world. The first Project Report contest, held last year, has had more than 3 million hits on YouTube. The contestants' work will be judged on the quality of the stories and the production values of the videos. 10 finalists will be chosen from the first round to receive computers and cameras. Those 10 will then compete to receive one of five $10,000 grants to work on an underreported international story. The Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting focuses on quality international journalism, educational programs, and media literacy. Managing Director Natalie Applewhite says that it's an opportunity to showcase underreported stories and to inspire higher production values.
A lot of the new media world, I mean, everybody's grabbing a camera and there's some wonderful, wonderful things being produced, but in some ways, maybe the traditional journalism values within that are not always known or valued. And so we hope that this would inspire some real quality productions and the opportunity for all of us to hear stories that we wouldn't otherwise be hearing about.
The theme for this year's Project Report is to document a day in the life of a compelling person the world should meet and showcase how that person is making a positive impact on his or her community. Applewhite says that the goal of the contest is to find inspirational characters and then tie their stories to larger issues. Another goal is to get the stories out to the widest possible audience. In addition to YouTube, the Pulitzer Center has relationships with traditional media and broadcast outlets that will highlight the contest stories.
For the five grand prize winners, we'll work with them directly. It's a mentoring relationship, and that will be to produce five international stories. So for us, this is a wonderful opportunity to supplement the international reporting projects that we're already doing. And having that happen in partnership with YouTube is also gives the promise of having these stories actually reach the YouTube audience, which isn't always necessarily looking for quality documentary stories. But if you highlight them, people do watch them. So you have to be putting good stories out there for people to know that they want good stories, right?
For more information, go to youtube.com/projectreport.
Jessica Clark and Tracy Van Slyke were both working at the Chicago-based Progressive magazine In These Times when they started to notice a lot of books being written about something called the conservative noise machine, a description of the strategy used to push conservative talking points and opinions in the mainstream media. Where, they wondered, was an analysis about what was happening online in the new networked progressive media community and outside the cable news networks, talk radio shows, and major newspapers? Clark and Van Slyke set out to answer those questions and just published a new book called Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media. The book examines a moment in time where media is rapidly changing from a broadcast-centric world into a networked one. Jessica Clark explains.
So the book really takes a look at the evolution of the progressive media sector, both how traditional outlets have been adapting and how progressive activists, experts, politicians, and others have taken advantage of social media tools to get the word out, to do reporting, to examine mainstream media frames.
Beyond the Echo Chamber analyzes both the use and impact of social media on a broad range of issues, from gender representation in the media to influencing public policy.
For example, in the book, we take a look at people who are really concerned about the fact that there are not enough diverse voices in progressive media. We call that strategy moving beyond pale, male, and stale. We look at people who want to use media to really affect policy directly. We call that strategy taking it to the Hill. So if you're a local activist or media maker or councilman, you could just as easily use social media tools to bring people together, let them know what you care about and what to do next.
The authors hope that the book serves not only as a documentation, but also as a guide and tool.
We wanted it to be a narrative history of a really recent, emergent sector. We also wanted people to be able to pick it up and turn it to the chapter that they were interested in. Each chapter has its own sort of strategic recommendations. And we anticipate that the visuals will sort of give people a larger sense of the ecosystem and allow them to think about how to strategize over time.
For more information, visit beyondtheecho.net.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 14th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Before we go to today's guest, I have an important announcement. I hope you'll pay careful attention. 1 week from today, on February 21st, we're going to have the first live performance of Media Matters, of this program, in the Siebel Center at 201 North Goodwin Street, right across the street from Campbell Hall here. And it's free and open to the public. We hope you will come. We've got plenty of room, I think, but we would appreciate it if you possibly could to call to let people know you're coming, but to RSVP, so to speak. But again, it's free and open to the public. We'll start at 12:30. Doors will open at noon. We'll start at 12:30, and it's going to be a special show. My longtime collaborator and running mate, John Nichols, is driving down from Madison. He'll be joining us for a couple hours. We'll start at 12:30. We'll talk for about a half hour. Then we'll do the Media Matters program live to a studio audience. The questions a week from today will come entirely from the studio audience. Then after the show's over, we will sign copies of our brand new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, which will be available at the event next week. You don't have to buy it if you don't want to, but the good news is, and the great news is, that anyone who buys the book will get it signed if they'd like by the authors, but also all proceeds from the book, every single penny, go directly to WILL, no one else. So it's really an effort of that we're making here at the program to help support the station in these times in which every penny counts for public broadcasting. And I know anyone listening to this program understands the importance of WILL. I don't need to make that sales pitch. Next week is a chance to have a great opportunity to hear Nichols and me yak, and also to get a copy of the book, support the station. It's going to be a lot of fun. Again, the doors open at noon at the Siebel Center at 201 North Goodwin. There's parking just a block away in the garage at Goodwin and Clark Streets. And then we'll start at 12:30, and then the show goes from 1 to 2, and we'll stick around from 2 to 3 to talk to people, sign books, answer questions. Generally, it should be a great time. Please do try to come. And if you do come, or do want to come, please make the phone call to confirm you're coming, just so they get a sense of the body count, and just call 333-7300, 333-7300 if you can. Not a huge deal if you don't forget to call, but most important, make sure you get to the Siebel Center next week for Media Matters, 1 week from today, 167 and a half hours from right now. Look forward to seeing you. I know John Nichols is really excited to get to beautiful Urbana and see that town in action. Our guest today is someone who I'm really privileged to have on the program. He's written a book that I think is one of the most provocative and interesting books. And a book that, even if you disagree with his conclusions, even if one disagrees with his analysis, the evidence is so compelling, it really forces everyone to deal with it. And when you read the descriptions and reviews of the book, it's astonishing the range of opinion of people who have been affected by this book, from the chief economist at Business Week to Barbara Ehrenreich, both praising it for its sort of singular ability to force people to rethink how they understand the American economy. So it's my great privilege on that note to welcome to Media Matters today Barry Lynn, author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction. Barry Lynn, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be there today, Bob.
Well, first of all, Barry, I very much enjoyed your book and meant what I just said about it. It was really a stunning read for me. As one who studied economics, and we have economic guests on this program probably six or seven times a year. We'll have Joe Stiglitz in a few weeks. We've had Dean Baker repeatedly, and Paul Krugman, and Jamie Galbraith, and a bunch of other economists, Mark Weisbrot. This book still taught me a lot of stuff I really didn't know, and I think it really challenged a lot of sort of the conceptions I had about how American capitalism works today and has worked for some time. What's a little bit of your background? Where do you come from to do a book like this?
Well, mainly I am a journalist, and I've been a journalist around the world for about 25 years. And when I say around the world, I started off in Latin America. I worked with the Associated Press in Peru. I worked for the Agence France-Presse in Venezuela, in the Caribbean. And then for most of the 1990s, I ran a magazine called Global Business. And then about 2000, I really started into this different space of what we're doing freelance and really delving deeply into the issues that I have gathered together and cornered. I had a previous book called End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation, which the way we talk about things nowadays, it was really a book about things that are too big to fail. It's about looking at the industrial system and how it's been reorganized around systems that are too big to fail. But the reason I'm actually, the list of economists that you just mentioned, I mean, it's like those are the, you know, I know Joe Stiglitz, and Dean Baker's a really good friend, and Jamie Galbraith as well. And, you know, those are great guys. And but the one thing that I have that it distinguishes me from them, and especially from the rest of the economists, is that I am a reporter, and that I go out and I actually just look at how things are built and how they actually function.
And, you know, Barry Lynn, as I read the book, I mean, what's really striking is for most Americans, and I think certainly it's almost taken for granted in political discourse from both political parties and in almost all the press coverage and punditry about our economy, it's sort of a given that we live in this exceptionally competitive market and that the competition has been elevated and enhanced by both globalization and free trade on one side and by the internet and new technologies, so that we're in just this hyper-competitive environment now, sink or swim, survival of the fittest. And your book basically, strikingly, says that's entirely wrong. Talk about it for a second.
Well, what I say is entirely wrong is the idea that the corporations are out there competing for us. That's generally wrong. I mean, there's still a few cases in which you see corporations bringing better stuff to us, and it's because there's real rivalry in the system. But in throughout the system, what we see is cases in which real control has been sort of captured over some activity or other by the people who run some corporation or other. And the thing is that there's still competition within the system. It's just that the competition tends to be between the financiers who control the corporations and the rest of us. So we feel competition. We feel people sort of competing for the share of the profit in an activity that we have always been able to enjoy. We feel, you know, this money that's been in our pockets, that's been our share of the big pie being whittled away. We feel ourselves put into more competition with our friends and our neighbors for the few jobs that are out there. But at the upper levels where we should see competition, where we want to see competition, that's just increasingly not the case.
Well, Barry Lynn, in the book, you go through an aisle of a typical store in the United States, and you look at, you know, product type after product type. And what's stunning is that, and I think every example you give in the book, and this not just in the store example, but throughout industry after industry, even though there's a plethora of brands in a given area, there's usually only two or three companies that almost entirely dominate the sector.
Yeah, and actually there's one of the cases, I'll just give you a for instance, and this is one that really shocked me, and it takes a lot to shock me, but I was in eastern Tennessee, and I was talking to a dairy farmer, an independent yeoman dairy farmer. Guy's got 70 cows. He's on farming land that's been in his family for generations. Wants to pass the farm on to his son. And I was talking to him about what's the most difficult challenge in his life. And he's like, well, there's no place to sell my milk. You know, here I am in this valley, but I can't sell my milk to my own neighbors. Well, I said, well, why is that? Well, it's because Walmart, everyone goes and buys their milk at Walmart. So, and that's a different system. So my milk ends up going across the Blue Ridge to the one last independent processor on the other side of the Blue Ridge. So then I said, well, okay, where is Walmart getting its milk? What are the companies that are refusing to buy from this fellow I'm talking to, this farmer? So I went back to the milk case in the Walmart in Elizabethton, Tennessee, and I looked, and there's three big brands of milk there. One of them says Mayfield, one of them says Pet Dairy, and the other one says Great Value, which is Walmart's in-house brand. And I said, well, there's a lot of competition here. You'd figure that one of these companies would want to deal with this fellow, this farmer. Then I did a little bit of digging on, like, who owns these brands. It turns out that Pet Dairy and Mayfield are both brands that are owned by this one company called Dean Foods. And it turns out that the local Mayfield Dairy actually happens to bottle all of the milk that goes out in the Walmart under the Great Value brand. So here I am, like, standing in front of this milk case, and you see all these different brands, and you think you got all of this choice, and there's different price points, and there's, you know, all these different different options that you seem to have, but actually it was 100% the same milk, all coming from the exact same place. And what was worse about it than the fact that it's just affecting us as consumers, that we're being manipulated, that there's no competition in this Walmart, is the fact that here's our neighbor. If I happen to live there, here's my neighbor up on the hill in the Watauga Valley, and he cannot get his milk to me because this giant company is, using its power to put a wall between me and my own neighbor.
Birrilyn, there are a couple of things that were striking, because I think normally when most people think about monopoly and concentration, they think of when one company corners the market for a product, or two or three companies basically control a market at what's called an oligopoly. And that's how we think of economic concentration. And you certainly, just in your example now, deal precisely with that in our book. But there are a couple other layers you added that I wasn't very familiar with that were really illuminating for me. And I'd like you to talk about them. The first one, actually, this occurred to me a couple of years ago. My wife and I were buying, I forget, some appliance for our kitchen because we were remodeling. It was either a microwave or a dishwasher or something like that. And we went to an appliance store, and we were looking at two or three different brands. And we asked the salesperson, to compare them for us. What's a better one? What's had better experiences? And he looked at us and he said, to tell you the honest truth, all of them are made in the same factory in China. They just slap different, they're basically the same machine, but no matter which one you buy, it's just different companies put different logos on them and different trademarks. And he made it seem like that's just how it's done everywhere. And it was really a newsflash to me. I had assumed, like the olden days, there were three companies with three different factories, and that they had different workers and different production methods and different materials, and there were different systems. Your book really, more than anything else, blows up that whole model of industrial production and a new world order in which oftentimes that example I gave is the rule increasingly.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, it's even in some of the marketplaces that seem to be the most competitive, like for automobiles. We look around and we see, there's 10 big companies in the United States at least that are selling us automobiles, and there's hundreds of different brands of automobiles. But what happened is that once upon a time, like about not that long ago, maybe 15 years ago, each of these corporations was vertically integrated. And that meant that, like you said, they had different teams of people and different lines of machines, and that they controlled the whole process. So that pretty much every part that went into their car was unique to that company. But what happened is that beginning about 15 years ago, when we really went through this outsourcing revolution, this is not necessarily offshoring, but the outsourcing, when companies would take a unit, say, to make wiper blades, and they would take that unit and they would sell it off. or they would close it down and go to an outside supplier, and they would outsource the production of or the purchase of some activity that they had been handling in-house. Well, at the time, it seemed like a really great idea, and it allowed for, there was all this mix, there was all this new competition, all these new connections that were created. But what then happened is that people came in and then grabbed control over these different activities. So, like, one guy would come in or one company would come in, and they would essentially monopolize, buy up all the companies that produce, say, piston rings. Or they would monopolize, they'd buy up all the companies that produce windshield wipers. So now what we have, like in the United States, you know, if you look at, you know, you go out to the store and you or to the car lot, and you're looking at, well, here's a GM product, and here's a Ford product, here's a Toyota product, here's a Nissan product. There's a lot of content that distinguishes those products from each other still, but increasingly what you see is down below is they have the same parts that come from the exact same places, the exact same companies, even the exact same factory. And just to show you, it's not merely just a problem in terms of the fact that it's just, you know, we're increasingly seeing this blending together of the companies, which has all of this ramification for pricing and innovation. There's the other problem, which is that, and this goes back to the too big to fail issue, is that when you have an entire industry reliant on a single factory, a single plant for a particular product, if that plant goes down, that factory goes down, the whole system goes down. And there's a whole bunch of cases recently in which we've seen that.
Yeah, and you document them in the book, just to add for listeners' sake. Why don't you give an example, Barry Lynn, if you would, of one of them?
Yeah, one of the ones that I spent the summer of 2008 in Japan, because I just wanted to really understand what had happened and what the Japanese were thinking. And this is the same in the United States, but the case was in Japan because there had been an earthquake there. And this earthquake knocked out a single piston ring factory in Niigata. And then when that factory went down, all 12 vehicle manufacturers in Japan went down within a matter of hours. They all shut their operations within a matter of hours because every single one of them was relying on this one plant for their piston rings, which is like a, you know, at mass production levels, that's a $3 part. So here it's like the efficiency that they say it's efficiency, but, you know, really they actually spent a lot of time talking to Toyota about this. I spent time talking to Honda about this. It's not merely just efficiency. It's also that once they put it outside, once they outsourced it, they lost control over it. And then people could come in and monopolize that activity. So, but there's actually even scarier ones. There was this case in 1999. There was an earthquake in Taiwan, knocked out semiconductor plants in Taiwan. And then it turned out that within a matter of days, all of these factories all across the United States shut down because they were all sourced, they were all taking semiconductors out of the same factories in this one town in Taiwan called Hsinchu. And it was, if that had been a really bad earthquake, which it was not, that could have created a catastrophic crash, industrial crash. Because, and it's just like when Lehman Brothers went down in 2008, the system, the financial system, was structured so that when one company went down, one bank went down, everyone went down. That's why we had to bail them out. Well, we've done the same thing with our industrial system. So increasingly, if one large factory goes down, if it's a keystone factory, we see massive, potentially catastrophic crashes of industrial activity.
Why would companies do this? That doesn't make any sense. It seems like if you were the company that stayed out of that system and had your own suppliers, you did it yourself, then when that happened, you'd be the one who'd be in the catbird seat.
Oh, that's a great question. That's really what I got into this, because when I first started looking at this, it was actually that earthquake in Taiwan that alerted me that there was something wrong. And that's when I went out and started to use my reporting skills trying to figure out what it was. And I figured that someone had to have an understanding of this someplace, because it's so crazy. It's so insane to build a system like this. So I spent the first couple of years just digging around, thinking, well, I'm going to find the person I'm going to find the paper, the study, the book that's going to show what's really going on here. And I just never found it. And what I realized is that what had happened in our countries for most of the 20th century, and actually going way back into the 19th century, large industrial firms at the board level, the engineers were very powerful. The people who understood how to build things were very powerful within these companies. Often they were the CEOs. The people who understood the systems were very powerful. Over the last 25 years, control over the corporations, even as the corporations were being used, being used to monopolize certain activities, control over the corporations was shifting from professional managers, professional engineers, to financiers.
Mm-hmm.
And financiers, when they look at the system, they got a very different view. They have a very different outcome they want.
So banks, hedge funds, equity funds, yeah. Basically people who are in the business of just dealing with paper.
Yeah, so basically what I realize is that our entire industrial system nowadays has been engineered by financiers whose interest is not the maintenance of systems over the long term, not the production of better products. It is simply the manufacture of cash and the transfer of that cash into their pockets. So basically, you know, what we've seen is this kind of sacking, this looting of our industrial systems has been going on for 25 years. And in the process, one of the things they looted, I mean, it's like all of these machines that they used to make, these people and skills and machines that were here in our country that, you know, allowed Americans to make things for other Americans. Well, a lot of that got basically sold offshore to people in China or companies in China or companies in Vietnam. But also what happened, one of the things is that these systems, part of the wealth in the systems was their resiliency, their redundancy, the fact that any kind of big problem, whether it's a natural disaster, political disaster, that they would always continue to operate. They were, you know, the wealth in the system was the resiliency of the system was one of the elements of wealth that was in the system. And that wealth has been stripped out by the financiers. And so they basically took these systems and they rebuilt them around, well, you know, one of the terms of art would be around single points of failure. But, what you know, basically another way to look at it is they built it around monopolized production systems. And that means that these systems, besides the fact that we have higher prices, less variety, less innovation, we also have systems that are on the verge of breaking down almost any day, for all kinds of different reasons.
Our guest you've just been listening to is Barry Lynn, author of the brand-new book, Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction, an extraordinary book. We're just giving you a brief taste of it so far here on Media Matters. Our phone numbers, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Barry Lynn, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller already waiting patiently. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line one, Champaign, you're on the air.
Yeah, there's two points. One is in terms of subsidies. That certainly doesn't help competition. You know, we see it in the agriculture. Do you have cover that a section in your book at all or not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do. I cover agriculture in some depth. I look, to some extent, I spend a lot of time looking at the functioning of commodities markets, and this is for both grains and energy as well. And just to sort of, you know, sort of look at how the pricing of our grains, the pricing of our oil, our energy, is manipulated by traders like those at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, speculators. But I also look at the agriculture system. I don't spend a lot of time looking at subsidies. I mean, subsidies are essentially, you know, subsidies are this kind of, one of the things we have, what we're dealing with here is this idea that there are free markets. And the basic idea of a subsidy is that, well, you're trying to, like, fix, make a free market work better. Now, there is no such thing as a free market. you know, every single activity that takes place in our political economy is political in nature. Every single relationship is fundamentally political. Now, there's wise reasons why we want to move the government, you know, out of sort of managing day-to-day activities, such as by providing subsidies to some and not subsidies to others. But the thing about what we should keep in mind about subsidies is not, you know, they're basically based on a myth. They're based on a mythic idea that there's a free market, that if you just sort of like provide a little bit of help here, you can actually get this market back into some sort of balance. So in some ways, it's like even worse than what, you know, your implication. It's not just the fact that they're actually fortifying these powers, but it's based on a myth.
Yeah, the other one that concerns me a great deal is quality. What's happened is that, you know, when the Japanese, in terms of turnaround, you know, their quality got extremely good. But in terms of China, with all the manufacturing there, I haven't bought a product. Most products I ever buy, I usually have to take them back, you know, and get another one. I mean, the quality is just, it seems to me that it's a huge waste of society. I know they're getting these products really cheap, and what happens is these companies are making a lot of money. So,
you're dead on, and the thing about quality, that's what the economics of destruction, my subtitle is basically, part of what I'm aiming at there is the fact that the quality of so many of our products is being driven down day by day.
You know, Barry, if I can interrupt.
These financiers using our corporations. The corporations are governments. That's what they are. Now, they'll go around and they'll tell you that, even now you see the Tea Party people, we've got to get government out of our lives. Well, the fact is that corporations are just private governments. So if you get main or public government out of the way, all you do is you just give more power to the private government.
You know, Barry Lynn,
right now, these private governments, the financiers are using them to extract cash from the industrial systems that we, the American people, built up over the course of 200 years. These are our machines. These are our ideas. These are our technologies. These are our jobs that we've been passing down from generation to generation. These financiers come along and they use these private governments to extract cash from the system in ways that actually destroys the machines, destroys the technology, destroys the quality of the products. And it ends up, you know, affecting the food we eat. It affects the clothing that we wear. It affects the quality of the wallboard that's in our houses.
You know, Barry Lynn, I when I read your book, one thing that was striking to me and it really dawned on me is just the point you're making right there, which is we're told we live in this super hyper-competitive market where the consumer is king. Yet in almost all our daily dealings, most people I know are incredibly frustrated with the corporations they have to deal with, whether they be phone companies, cell phone companies, cable companies, health insurance companies. It seems at every level people feel like they're getting screwed over and they have very little recourse. And it didn't make any sense if you're supposed to have these competitive markets where you have all these options. And your book really sort of clarified that, I think, in a lot of ways. And the question I have is the other point I want to make sure we get out on the table from your book that I don't think many people have really thought about as well as you've done, is the great change in our economy, in addition to the role of finance and taking over our corporations and changing the industrial structure, has been the really phenomenal change in the reconstruction of the retail sector in the United States in the past three decades from what was predominantly a local and fairly competitive market nationwide to a highly monopolistic national market. Can you talk a little bit about what has happened and why we should care about that?
Yeah, that's one of the most important things that has happened is, a generation ago, across the United States, every city, every town had its own department stores. They had every city, every town had its own discount stores. It had its own restaurants. It had its own, you know, men's clothing stores. And there was a number of one of the things that happened. Because of that structure in which you had the retail system, power within the retail system distributed every place, is that the people who actually made things in this country, the people who made our shirts, they made our food, they were able to price the stuff that they're making and deliver it to us as consumers. You know, they would send, you know, they put a price on a shirt, they put a price on a can of food, and it would go out through the system, and it would be delivered to us by this whole different, all these different retailers. And we had essentially it was a market system. So that if we didn't like the price that these people were putting on it, then we wouldn't buy that can, we wouldn't buy that shirt, and we'd go buy something else. And then the retailers, what they did back then is like, well, they served us because they would go out and say, well, we think this price of this can is too high. We're going to bring in this other can, which we think will help our neighbors, because remember, these were people in their own community, by bringing in a better can at a lower price or a better shirt at a lower price. So we had a real functioning system. What happened a generation ago is two things. One, they shifted the power to price a product from the producer to the retailer. There was a law in 1975, shifted the power to price a product. So suddenly it's like the people who actually make something, they don't have the ability to price that product. Kind of a crazy idea, but we could spend all day talking about why they did that. Then what happened in 1981, they changed the antitrust laws. They essentially overthrew our antitrust laws.
Was that a formal act, or was that just...
They want to be.
Well, just to get in the book, because it's such a key part of your book, in your argument, Barry Lynn. In 1981, when the Reagan administration came in, did they formally, like, eliminate the antitrust laws, or did they just stop enforcing them?
They essentially, they changed the frame that they used to enforce the antitrust laws. Before 1981, the basic idea was that antitrust law, or anti-monopoly law, was political in nature. We, the people of the United States, use our anti-monopoly laws to protect ourselves from concentration of political power. One of the things that we would tend to, it was a byproduct of that, is that we ended up protecting the people who actually produce things. You know, the farmers, the people who produce, the toothbrushes and toothpaste. What then happened, in 1981, the Reagan administration came in and said, you know, from now on, one of the things that this old way, this competition for the sake of competition way of enforcing our anti-monopoly laws, what that is leading to is inefficiencies. That's leading to cases in which prices are just a little bit higher than they might otherwise be. And then they came out with this idea that instead of using our anti-monopoly laws to protect ourselves against concentrated political power, we should use our anti-monopoly laws to promote efficiency. And they came up with a whole different term. They call it consumer welfare test for anti-monopoly, for the enforcement of our anti-monopoly law. So that rather than using our anti-monopoly laws to protect us out as citizens, we were supposed to use it instead to protect ourselves as consumers. So in combination with that change in law, in terms of who got to price the product that happened in 1975, you put those two things together, and we have seen this explosion of trading companies in this country. It's Walmart. Walmart now controls 50% plus of certain lines of business in the United States. Lines of business that were, like, say, pet food, sale of pet food. This is a business that was spread out among hundreds of thousands of families in the United States selling pet food through the local store, through the, you know, their, so the local convenience store, the local grocery store. That now 50% of that business is held by Walmart, but it's also Home Depot. It's also Best Buy. All of those activities that were spread out among all those different families, they've now been captured under the roofs of these few giant trading companies. And it's because of those changes in the law that sort of unleashed these powers.
And isn't that great, though? We all get these low prices forever, and we can get more bang for our buck as consumers?
Well, yeah, you know, it's sort of, that's what they tell us, you know. And but the problem is that, as the previous caller was mentioning, it's like what happens is that the way the power is exercised leads to massive degradation of the products themselves. As the much of the fact that these low prices that they tell us that they're delivering is a lie, because if you're in that store in Tennessee, that Walmart in Elizabeth, Tennessee, and you're looking at that wall of milk that's all coming from one company, there's no competition there. That price is an arbitrary price. It's not set through competition. That means the people in that valley are paying more for their milk than if there was an actual competitive system there. So, the way they exercise power, when they do exercise power, tends to lead to worse products. Two, in a growing number of cases, it's just a plain lie, and they're actually charging us more.
Our guest, Barry Lynn, author of the brand-new book, highly acclaimed book, Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction. He's joining us live if you want to call in with a question or comment. The telephone number here at Media Matters, 333-945, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line 1, Coles County, you're on the air with Barry Lynn.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I just tuned in, so I apologize if this has been covered. But I heard the term market manipulation used with respect to commodities and specifically with respect to crude oil. And what I'd like you to do, please, is to look back to 1999 when oil was trading for $12 a barrel and gasoline was $1 a gallon. Now, was that market manipulation or was that the free market?
Thank you very much, caller. Barry Lynn, is that something you can handle?
No, absolutely. I mean, in 1999, there was this, if you go back and you look at, you actually have to go back not just to 1999, it's really important to go back to about 1981. And this is one of the things I do in my book, is that I take people through a series of changes that led to, the, you know, where we are today in oil. And what you see is this, back in 1981, most oil was priced on long-term contracts. And that meant that it was like basically Exxon and Saudi doing a deal for Argus crude. And so, okay, we're going to set the price at $25 a barrel, and we're going to do this for the next 2 years. And we're going to try and keep it stable, and that was the old way. People wanted stability, except during crises, when there were political crises. And that was the two political crises that really disrupted the old stable system were the oil embargo of 73, 74, and the Iran Revolution of 79. So the old system was super stability, and then when there was volatility, pricing volatility, was all of that was sort of isolated in the spot market in the old days. So you had the spot market going up and down, but most people saw the price of, you know, their oil was delivered, gasoline to their cars, it was very, very stable over long periods of time. What they have done now is they nowadays jump ahead 30 years from when the Reagan people came in, and you've had this whole series of changes that basically have tied every single drop of oil, every single drop of gasoline in the United States to every event that happens around the world. So the volatility in the system is global. We're not able to isolate it anymore in the spot market. So anytime there's a break in the flow of oil out of a pipeline in Nigeria, suddenly it's like we see our oil going up. It doesn't make any sense, but that's the way the system is structured now. Now, in between 1999, when the caller mentioned, and now, what happened is that 1999, you saw OPEC reorganize itself. So OPEC finally was able to put a floor. They had lost control for about 10 years over the price of oil, about 8 years. They reorganized themselves, they put a floor, they tried to keep it at about $75, but then what happened is that all of these other changes in how the price oil is priced, once they got the floor in, then the speculators were able to drive it up. And that started in about 2003. And it wasn't just oil. I mean, I'm doing a story on steamships. To give you a sense of what happened in the tankers and steamships that carry our oil and our wheat around the world, one type of steamship, like the same thing happened with Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, set up desks to trade in steamship futures in about 2001. 2003, they really turned on the juice. They drove the price of a daily charter from a very steady rate of about $30,000 a day. They drove it up to $304,000 a day. That was in summer of 2008. And then when that bottom fell out, it fell down to $4,000 a day. So what we have is it's a long, complicated process in which you have this effort by political institutions, OPEC and the U.S. government, Europeans, the Japanese, the Chinese, to create stable systems. And then you have the speculators coming in. And when you get it's now structured so that there's even the slightest bit of of pull in the market, they can drive that price to just spectacular heights.
Barry Lynn, our guest today on Media Matters, author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism, The Economics of Destruction. I really regret, Barry, there's so much great material in this book that you write about that's original that I haven't seen elsewhere, and I read widely in this area. And we're only going to touch a glimmer of it, unfortunately, in the hour we have available. But I am going to try to get to a couple of things I think that were very interesting about the book. First of all, before I get back to the phone lines, I want you to talk a little bit about Milton Friedman and his role in all this, and specifically the contradiction that a lot of my students have raised to me and friends have raised to me over the years, which is ostensibly the Chicago theory of economics is based on the greatness of competition, and competition being sort of the force that requires businesses to serve people and not sort of use monopoly power. And in theory, one would think, therefore, there'd be a strong commitment to antitrust law and anti-competitive law to make sure markets are competitive and not monopolistic. Yet, as you point out in the book, Milton Friedman was almost the champion of monopoly, yet all under the guise of free markets. And talk a little bit about that for our listeners, because it's a really illuminating discussion in the book.
Yeah, Milton Friedman, he wrote a book, published this book that's really just a collection of essays in 1962 called Capitalism and Freedom. And that one book was really, you know, if you can really read that as the primer for the whole Chicago School Revolution. And what they did, you're absolutely right, they said these guys have presented themselves as the champions of free market competition. But if you read very carefully, what you see is actually, and I went through and I looked at the use of the term free market, for instance. What I found is that Milton Friedman in 1962 essentially coined the term free market. Before that, I went through Schumpeter, I went through Smith, I went through Hayek, through Keynes. There is almost no use of the term free market. There's a couple of cases in which it really just meant open market, but hardly any uses at all of the word free market. So what I basically came across is when you read very carefully in what Milton Friedman wrote, is he basically has all these conversations about antitrust and how we should never, ever, ever apply antitrust laws to corporations. He didn't say we should get rid of our antitrust laws because he wants them applied to unions, and he wants them applied to guilds like the American Medical Association. So when people try to get together and create like a cooperative relationship of some sort, then the antitrust government should get in and break that up. But when capitalists get together and create a cooperative relationship, which is necessary, I mean, I'm not saying, I mean, creating combinations of capital to do important things, that's one of the basic activities that keeps our economy going. But he basically said the government should have no voice whatsoever in who gets to combine and how they get to combine. And then going back to the term free market, basically what he advocates, if you look very carefully what he's advocating, he's advocating classic laissez-faire. Classic laissez-faire in the United States basically is, and this is going back to the idea that there's two forms of government. There's private government, as through our private corporations, and then there's public government. Classic laissez-faire, the people with the classical proponents of classical laissez-faire were that came of age in the United States late in the 19th century during the Gilded Age, and it was people like J.P. Morgan, like John D. Rockefeller, and they were saying, well, just let us run these systems. Because it's the most efficient way to allow us to run the railways is for me, J.P. Morgan, to run the railways and as a private governor of the system, or for me, John D. Rockefeller, to run all of oil as the private dictator of the system, and that's efficient. And that was classic laissez-faire. So when what Milton Friedman basically was trying to resurrect was the classic vision of laissez-faire in which power would be concentrated in private government. But then to hide that fact, because people understood what the word laissez-faire meant, he coins this new phrase. New phrase was free market. So it was kind of this Orwellian twist that worked really quite well. So now we walk around in this country, we walk around, and there are people using corporations to reach into our pocket and pull money out of it. People using corporations, which are human institutions, they come in and they, like, prevent me from talking to my neighbor, from trading with my neighbor. And we look at this and we go, oh, it's just market forces. When, in fact, it's corporate forces. It's people using human institutions to prevent other people from doing things or to rip off other people. But so this, you know, what Milton Friedman managed was, it was truly a phenomenal Orwellian achievement.
On that note, Barry Lynn, author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction. Let's go back to our phone lines to another caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm not an economist. I am an historian, 19th and 20th century Europe, basically. And what strikes me is that, in a broad way, what you're saying replicates and instantiates a great deal that was said in the big debates over socialism versus and Marxist socialism and free the advocates of capitalism in the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, Rudolf Hilferding and Karl Kautsky and Rosa Luxemburg and even, you know, V.I. Lenin. And this is not at all intended as a criticism. I think it's a kind of tribute to the fact that these people have simply dropped out of, you know, we've assumed that the whole thing is dead and gone, that nobody even thinks about this anymore. Capitalism good, socialism, communism all bad and the like. I was wondering what your reaction was to this, whether I'm sure you know about this and whether there's any connection between that and what you're doing.
I agree with you entirely.
Hang up now and listen to your answer.
Thank you very much, caller. And, you know, Barry, before you answer, let me just say that this is a theme, actually, that you discuss at some length in the book, which is the common ground at times of the socialist tradition with some of the corporatist tradition.
Yeah, the caller was, you know, exactly right. These discussions in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, we discussed these issues back then at length. The difference was that we were all, at that point, people were honest about what they were advocating. People were honest about whether they were advocating laissez-faire, private governance. People were honest about whether they were advocating socialism in terms of when I use the word socialism in this case, it means top-down control by the public government over the apparatuses of production. Or they were honest about the fact that they were actually advocating some form of corporatism, which is kind of when you got the private governments and the public governments in some kind of a mix, and you hope that something good will come out of it. So 100 years ago, we had these debates, and they were very honest debates. And one of the reasons that we're having so much trouble in this country today understanding what's going on in our own political economy is because our language was taken away from us. Our language was perverted. That was the great achievement of Chicago School, was to pervert our language, to take away the most fundamental tool that we use to understand what goes on around us. So when it's like a corporation's reached in my pocket, oh, that's the free market. When you got trading companies that are determining the distribution of labor across the face of the earth, oh, that's free trade. So, and then we believe it, or at least actually most Americans don't actually believe it. One of the things I've found is that people outside of Washington, outside of New York, outside of Los Angeles, know full well what's going on in this country because they still use common sense to interpret what's going on.
But if I can interrupt you on that point, Barry, how good of a job do you think our news media does in sort of explaining what is going on as you see it in the real economy people live compared to the sort of fantasy world of free market economic theory?
Basically, an incredibly poor job. And there's a simple reason for that, which is that the media in this country have been trained to outsource all thinking about economics to the economist, to the professional economist. And rarely do they go and talk to the people like Dean Baker or Jamie Galbraith or Joe Stiglitz. I mean, Joe Stiglitz is getting, you know, a good amount of play recently. But most of the time they go and they talk to these guys who are working at Goldman Sachs or working then in Chicago at the university or in Harvard. He's academic economist. So what happens is, I mean, and I do this, I deal with this all the time, is like talking to a journalist and they're like, well, what do the economists say? What do the economists say? And the fact is the economists, I mean, it's too long to go into like what's wrong with the economics profession as a whole, but they have no idea what's going on in the world. So then you have these journalists who should be going out and using their own senses, their own reason to understand what is happening in our world. And they look at it, and they actually will do that, and they say, this looks wrong. And then they'll go talk to an economist, and the economist will befuddle them. And then they will write essentially what's nonsense. And
you know,
report to us nonsense.
Barry Lynn, author of Cornered, The New Monopoly, Capitalism, The Economics of Destruction. We've only got a few minutes left, and I think it's important before we close the show that we talk about two things I want you to address for a couple of minutes, if you would, which is the fact that in our political system today, both political parties are part of the problem, in your view. There's not like a good guy party and a bad guy party. And secondly, what is the solution? What is the way out? I mean, what do you think the policy solution is to the great crisis of monopoly in our economy that, in your view, is dragging our economy down into the gutter?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is, I mean, our parties, and this goes back to the last caller, our parties today are very close, and it looks a lot like it did a century ago, in which you got one party, the Republicans, that are basically advocates of laissez-faire, of running the country through feudal private corporations. Then you have the other government, the other party, which is essentially advocating a form of, well, let's run it through the public sphere. Let's run it through the public government. And what you don't have is neither of the parties, basically the laissez-faire, the people who promote private governance and the people who promote public governments are essentially working together. And what they generally advocate is top-down, relatively authoritarian control over our political economy. And they kind of bounce the ball back and forth from one court to the other.
I read your book differently, Barry Lynn. I read your critique of, say, the Clinton administration was that it was, if anything, more gung-ho for the corporate sector than had been the Republicans. Certainly no less gung-ho. I hardly saw it as presenting any sort of government should step in and, you know, monk get in the way of corporations.
Oh, no, you're right. I mean, that's the Clinton administration, absolutely. But then what happens is, like, with the crisis in 2008, then it's like then the technocrats who are in government come out of the closet.
You know, we've only got a minute left, so if you would just, you know, get to, if you could, what sort of policy outcomes would get us to a better place?
Well, the most simple thing is just to recognize that the purpose of our political economy is entirely political in nature. The purpose of our anti-monopoly laws are to protect us against concentrated political power. So the first thing is just to simply see what is really around us, the fact that power has been concentrated in these political institutions, which are our corporations, and to work with each other. And this is, you know, people say, well, it's too big of a challenge, the powers are too great. And the fact is that most of us have been isolated in our little areas, and we don't see how in our little areas we can fix the world. I've been working with people. Last week, I was talking to the independent booksellers and independent book publishers.
You know, Barry Lynn, on that note, unfortunately, we have to interrupt you because I hear the band turning up in the background, which means they want to clear us out of the studio. I want to thank you for the great hour, and good luck with your book.
Well, thank you very much.
Barry Lynn, our guest, the author of Cornered, The New Monopoly, Capitalism, The Economics of Destruction. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for being my engineer. Melissa Trentz for being my producer. Remember, 1 week from today, everyone listening right now, show up to the Siebel Center at 12:30. We got a live Media Matters. We're going to be raising money for WILL, but it's all free to you to come, and you can purchase the book if you want to. We'd love to see you there. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone, have a great week.
W. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Here's the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana. Today, mostly cloudy skies, and there's a 20% chance of snow. The high will reach 28 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, and there's a 50% chance of snow. The low around 13. And President's Day, cloudy with a 40% chance of snow, a high of 25. Monday night, a low around 15. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.